Senior Focus. Welcome everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Curry, your presenter for this session of Senior Focus. And we have in the studio with us today our guest, John Elliott, who is the founder of Ponsonby News. And for people in central Auckland, they'll be very familiar with his columns in the Ponsonby News. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
And one of our fellow volunteers at Planet was telling me yesterday that John taught him at school.
Oh, there's a lot of people of great age that I taught, being in my ninth decade.
It was also quite exciting to discover the chair of the trust that runs Planet has also an association with John. So, you know, we're in good company. Welcome, John. And it's really good to have you on the program, because I've been an avid reader of your columns. Oh. And some of the columns that have stood out for me have been the ones that have been about social justice, in particular about the changes that are going on in New Zealand since the 80s, where we had the neoliberal shift in our society, where we suddenly got a bigger gap between richer and poorer people, and where we had mass unemployment occurring for the first time in our history since the 1930s. So with those changes that came in the 80s that have been compounded since, we've had some very interesting research written, and Max Rushbrook has written a very good analysis called The Inequalities of New Zealand, and he's outlined how this has come about, the situation where we've got these people who normally would have been part of the middle class who are actually struggling to keep food on the table, and we've got working poor, people who are working at three jobs, but they can't feed their kids or clothe their kids adequately because most of their income's going to pay these very high rents that we now have. So I just wonder if you'd like to comment on this yourself.
Yes, I read quite a lot of Max's work, and what I might do is comment on the neoliberal 10 or 20 years, which started in the Western world with Thatcher and Reagan, and then in New Zealand, Roger Douglas, and then followed on by Ruth Richardson. So we had Rogernomics and Ruthanasia, as they were called. Now, I'd like to tell listeners about an address I went to. It was a annual speech given by a bloke called Ted Thomas. Now, Ted Thomas is the Right Honourable Sir Edmund Thomas, retired Justice of the Court of New Zealand, and he said at that meeting, New Zealand will never ever be a just and fair society again until we rid ourselves of the last vestiges of neoliberalism. And although it's been discredited around the world, Anne-Marie, now, it still hangs on. It's still there. And we've still got the neoliberal influence on us. And so in America, you're talking about the middle class, they were hollowed out, they'd call it. They were hollowed out by the neoliberal phenomenon, and it's created a huge gulf between the rich and the poor. And now we've got a large number of in poverty in New Zealand. The present government is doing its best. Jacinda is the minister in charge of poverty, and she's doing her best, but it's a huge problem, and it started with that free enterprise, get rid of the state, private enterprise knows best, and let the market run and rule. And it was a failure.
And it's one of the most difficult things to turn around at the local level.
Yes, 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 it is, and it's become so, I suppose, I don't know, endemic is the word. It's become so imbued in our society that we still hear people criticising the state, nanny state, telling us what to do, what to have for breakfast, and so on. And I was talking to a good old right winger friend of mine the other day, and he said, "Your socialist government," and he was talking about, and he's scathing about the Labor government. And I said, look, back when the welfare state was instituted in New Zealand by the first Labor government, they decided that we had to look after the old and the young and the sick and the underprivileged and give them some state help where necessary and let private enterprise do its thing as well. So we had both the state and private enterprise functioning side by side. When Labor was in power, the state got a bit more say. When National was in power, private enterprise got a bit more sway. But now, unfortunately, despite Max Rashbrook and others, the state has become, in many eyes, a dirty word again. And I think that's a shame.
Yes, and I think also that the market rules takes on a whole different meaning now when it's a global market,
yes.
When we've got faceless corporations the size of Google and so on, and some that pay no tax in our country, and yet they're creaming money off our citizens.
It's a dilemma, isn't it? In some mornings I wake up and say, let's shut the door and let the rest of the world get on with their troubles, and we'll be isolationist. We can grow enough food to look after ourselves. We don't need any more people to populate us. We're doing fine with the cast of 5 million. But on the other hand, we sell our agricultural products and others to the world. We feed the world, and we feed countries that we don't like ideologically. We feed China and others, and so I've come to the conclusion that we've got to be in a certain way international in our attitudes. But you're quite right, there are corporations now that are bigger than 50 or 100 countries in the world in their own right. Each corporation. Mm. And some of them, like Monsanto and others that bring chemicals to us and push stuff on us that we don't want, are very difficult to ward off.
They are indeed. Firstly, because of the extensive arms of capitalist activity that they control.
Yeah.
I mean, look even at China itself. I mean, you might be criticising what they're doing to the Uyghurs or, whatever other human rights abuses you see, but you know that opening your mouth has consequences. And so, you know, it's difficult to actually understand just how much these tentacles are interwoven, and how much power is behind them all when we're trying to have a free trade agreement with the UK or the US. We have to bear in mind that there are lobbying groups with great power that work with these entities that will influence that whole conversation behind the scenes, not in a public way. So it isn't easy, and we might look as though we're throwing stones at glass houses on occasions too. So we have to draw breath and be mindful of the processes that we're entwined in. But New Zealand's always been good at diplomacy. I think we've had some very successful and practical diplomats who've done really well for us. And I think that we've used sport in a very successful way to influence activities and changes around the globe. We
did you go to any of the 81 Springbok Tour games?
I remember I was actually working for the Ministry of Education when Donna Awatere was mysteriously missing in action from work at that time. It was very, and we were being watched very carefully to see, you know, where we were and so on. I was being forced to travel into the Wairarapa and work in the Wairarapa.
Oh, okay.
And I remember coming back over the Rimutaka Hill Road when the Red Squad were unleashed in Molesworth Street.
Okay.
And I could hear the batons hitting people on the head. And it wasn't, it was something I'll never forget because it was on radio.
Right.
It was very live.
Yeah.
And of course, there was a prominent mayor of Porirua. Her daughter was brain damaged as a result of one of those beat-ups.
Well, what you were talking about New Zealand, though, in the world, and we set up that welfare state back in the 30s, and neither the left or the right, it was always National or Labour who were in power, and neither of those parties abolished the welfare state. They changed it bits and pieces, and National did some eroding of some of the rights, but basically those were all kept in place until this neoliberalism came in the mid-80s.
That's right.
We were pretty much an egalitarian society right through until that mid-80s. Mm-hmm. That's when it changed, didn't it?
It did, and I grew up in the 50s, and I don't remember any children going to school without shoes. Mm. I don't remember children not having lunch. I don't remember ever seeing anyone begging in the street. You know, those things didn't exist.
No,
my mother, on the other hand, could tell me about children going to school in the snow with barely enough covering on their feet, maybe sandals. You know, my mother was conscious of poverty when she was going to school. That would have been in the 20s and, you know. But really, that was not, it was something I'd heard about, but it was something I'd never seen. So what I actually have seen now is what I predicted when I was a social science lecturer in the 1980s. Mm. I actually was saying to my students, what you've got to do is take a long-range view at the impact of neoliberalism and see what happens. You don't have to believe me, but you can look with your own eyes over the next 10 to 15 years and see what unwraps. See how the society breaks down, see how mental health issues arise, how people living and flatting with other people get shot or attacked, how people get randomly the victims of violence in the street, and how many people are going without food and who are begging and, you know, right on in your face when you go to the bank. And I said, this will happen. You can't see it now, but this will happen. This will be the result of these policies.
Well, it's happening. And it's happening now.
Yeah, and I wonder how many of them, you know, remember those words.
Yes. Well, it's happening now. If my partner was guidance counsellor, she did a course at AUT, and she was at Selwyn College for a period a couple of years ago, and there were young students there, one young girl particularly, who was bright and keen, but she was at the mercy of her family, who partied all the time. Uncles, in inverted commas, and others arrived and put her out of her bed, so she had to sleep on the couch, and then she couldn't sleep because she was on the couch, then she was molested by another uncle, and so on. And so that went on. That poor kid couldn't learn. She couldn't learn at all, and it was the opportunity was there, and the right wingers would say she had equal opportunity with everybody else, but she didn't because of her background and her home and so on. And so that's part of what's happened, isn't it?
It is definitely
with this breakdown in any kind of equality in New Zealand. It's now got, well, it's quite extreme, really. When you used to see the odd Rolls Royce around, Robbie, the famous Robbie Mayer, he had a Rolls Royce, and he used to walk to work and run a little bit, stripped to the waist, with the Rolls Royce following him. Rainton Hasty, who had a strip club at the end of Ponsonby Road, he had a Rolls Royce as well. There was a bit of that, and some of the farmers who were well off, and some of our famous farming names like Elworthy and Watty and so on, they were affluent, they were wealthy, but seldom flaunted it. And in recent years, we've had his and hers Ferraris, his and hers Lamborghinis, and so on. And so there's this flaunting of this new wealth, which is, it must be upsetting to factory workers and so on, basic workers in, say, in South Auckland, whose boss says, hooray, gets into his Audi or his Ferrari, I'm off for a long weekend in Sydney. These people can't go to Sydney for the weekend. They can hardly feed their kids. And so some of them go to the pub and think, oh, well, I might as well go to the pub. I can't go to Sydney. And so they're in dire straits. And that's the state we've got to now, which we didn't have in those 50s and 60s and 70s. We had a lot of problem still with Maori hidden around the fringes in old housing and so on, not part of society. So, and we had women who couldn't leave their husbands because there was nothing for a woman, if no domestic purposes, benefit or anything. Homosexuals couldn't be identify themselves. So there were a lot of things that were not right with our society, but it's the financial, the economics that's taken over instead of social values.
Yes, and I mean there was really up until the 80s, there was work. You could actually get work, and so people could recover themselves through, or they could patch up bad situations. They could find ways to get an income stream going, and also you could feed yourself off. There was a lot of kai available freely. Go to the beach, go into the forest, and people knew people who grew things. And there was a lot of free trading going on in the community. And even people who moved away from the community, they still had the community connections.
Yes.
And I remember, you know, the valley that my mother grew up in, which was just below the Kashmir School, below the Banks Peninsula Hills. In that valley, the families had just about every kind of small lifestyle block activity you could imagine. So some had fowl houses and some had glass houses and grew tomatoes and some had orchards and, you know, but they all used to trade their produce. And those people still dropped off boxes of tomatoes to my mother when she'd long since moved out of the area but lived in another part of Christchurch. You know, we benefited from all of that.
Yeah, I milked a cow morning and night before I went to school, and when I came home I milked a cow, and I rode ponies and horses in the show and so on, and we lived on 10 acres just on the fringe of Whangarei. And it was a idyllic childhood, idyllic lifestyle.
I remember having white-back patties for lunch. I mean, think about it, feasting like kings. We couldn't afford it now, but we could then.
Well, I've just been reading about decolonisation. You know, there's quite a swell to try and work out how this colonisation of Māori particularly can be decolonised. And one of the things that I've noticed in my reading is that a lot of it is environmental, and a lot of it is our kai moana that they lived on, gone or polluted. We've all done that. We've all polluted the waterways and the beaches and so on, and now they're still trying to put more tips in the Dome Valley and so on. So that's caused a lot of problems in New Zealand in relatively recent years.
Well, it's the old story that you don't know what you've lost till it's gone.
Yeah.
And I do believe that that's one of the really big issues now in terms of how do you keep people actually going in society if things are breaking down and people don't have access to food? Then you've got some serious issues on your hands, and this is one of the problems that people could rely on locals feeding locals, on people being able to get free kai, just by the plentiful supplies in the forest and at the beach and so on. Mm. And with all of those polluted or denuded or whatever, but it's always concerned me that the overseas fishing companies have been able to come in and fish out our waters.
Yeah.
And it's, I've always believed that the treaty had its protective silver lining in terms of actually it could protect the environment for all New Zealanders in a way. But the difficulty has been that we haven't actually employed it in that way. We haven't actually used it.
The Resource Management Act wasn't even able to do it, and it's being now abolished. And
is there going to be enough protection?
I doubt it. I'm quite worried about it. I'll be making submissions to David Parker's bill on this, but I think there's a problem. But we're talking about this inequality and talking about people being alienated and feeling left out of society. I've never seen so many gated communities and so many gated houses as there are now. I walk around the inner city quite a lot. And compared to what there were, we've been 30 years in our street, and compared to what there was even 10 years ago, you walk down Jervois Road, you walk around Herne Bay, and there's push buttons to get into every house with a huge wall in the front, and they're walled off from the rest of society. I say when the revolution comes, they might get a few bombs thrown over those fences by people who have given up on getting help from society. And so I think it's that's part of the gap that's been created, Anne-Marie. A lot of people just feel left out. In local government elections here in Auckland, only one in three people bother to vote.
Yes, and I do feel that we need a big conversation about this. I'm going to invite you back because I think that it's a bigger conversation than we can tackle this afternoon.
Sure.
And I think that it may in fact be something that we also run a panel for, because you've got space in the studio to have more people in.
Mm.
And I have had many conversations with a number of people who commentate on the death of democracy, on the struggle for community voice at the local level, on the dominance of central government over local government. And, of course, we've got a huge amount of change on the table at the moment with the Three Waters discussion, with the Resource Management Act, as you've just referred to, and with
the health department,
the restructuring of health, and of course, wherever you take away representation at the local level, wherever you cut that off, you leave the community less of a voice, less of an opportunity.
Yes,
but on the other hand,
that doesn't have to happen, though.
No, it doesn't.
In education, Tomorrow's School, set up by David Longy in Labor government, gave a lot more local autonomy to schools. But what tended to happen in a small country like New Zealand, principals of schools became assistant caretakers, really. They weren't getting on with their professional job. They were designing with a couple of architects on the board, if they had them. Not in South Auckland, they didn't, but in the more affluent areas, the new office or the new fence or the new gates. That sort of work, in my estimation, can be done on at least a regional and possibly on a national basis. And that's what it was. When I was a young teacher, the education department was responsible for all of those things. And a principal ran the school professionally, but wasn't an assistant caretaker or an assistant sort of admin person, you know?
Because the education board that they were in those days, they were very much, they had a strong property arm.
Yes, they did.
And that property arm was funded from central government, and it was very strongly centralised in terms of controls and accountability, and there was a certain standard of construction that was quality. Now, then we got the period where the fruits or the consequences of some of the devolution came in, where we had school halls that had black mould.
Yeah.
And I was working in the, I'm just trying to think. It was the early 2000s, and I was in Glen Innes, and one particular school had black mould through underneath the hall. And it got to the stage where the children were only going in the hall when all the windows and doors were open for full circulation, because, you know, you could just see the holes through the boards. You could just see the black mould. It was just hideous.
But, you know,
but it was very difficult because it impacted on health of the staff.
Yeah, but isn't that a symptom of the neglect of the public sector that the national parties over many years engineered and left? They wanted to balance the budget, and they didn't want to waste money on schools, health, other areas that they thought didn't merit it, you know?
And that's the problem. We've actually inherited a lot of underfunding, under-resourcing in a whole lot of areas.
Sale of state houses.
Yes, and we had the axing of the apprenticeship schemes. We had a whole lot of things, and these have all come home to roost, because the long-term consequences are hitting us now at the very time when our society's got its greatest need. We've had a population increase, and we haven't got the corresponding housing.
We should be talking about population intensification in Auckland and elsewhere too.
Well, that's another topic, and I think that you've got a lot to offer, John, because of the experience and the long-range view of things. Mm. And that's one of the difficulties, I believe, we have with decision-making, that decision-making is myopically short-term.
Yes.
It's controlled by the politicians in a three-year focus.
Yeah.
It's too narrow, and we're not actually thinking ahead enough. And climate change is actually something that people have been... Some people have been talking about for the last 20 years.
Oh, longer.
And longer. Mm. But it was never taken seriously. It wasn't on the decision-making table or at the policy table. Now we are having to play catch-up. And it's very scary because people suddenly realise, well, yes, we could make this decision, but what is it going to mean in 5 years' time? How much of a white elephant is this building or this investment going to be?
We've got a NTY, they call it, in government. Not this year, because it's the election year coming up. So not this year, NTY. Mm. And that's been a philosophy going through. Short-termism,
yes.
That's been a real problem.
And it's the death of quality decision-making in many respects.
Yes, it is. Yes,
and we need more Sir Peter Blakes, people who can take that visionary aspect but also can motivate people on the ground to do practical things.
My son, when he was 12, an intermediate, he went to Japan as a United Nations environment program for kids. I went with him as a father. Sir Peter Blake Trust.
How amazing.
Yeah.
Yes. So I can see rich discussion forthcoming, and that's the purpose of this program. And I just want to say that we are very excited to move into Planet's new forever home from the beginning of next year.
I heard from Rick, yes.
And after 33 years of very diligently saving, it's a great message to get out to people that small amounts of money saved over time can net you a very good prize. And
excellent.
We've been able to purchase a building, and so now we're really calling on people to come in and support donations and so on. And, of course, it's a tax-deductible trust, Planet FM.
Yeah.
So I'll be posting details on our Facebook page. I'll also be communicating with people I know who are keen on this program.
Mm.
And we're doing our own fundraising to make sure we're strong so we keep going as a program individually.
Mm.
But at the same time, we also are very glad to have a forever home.
Oh, congratulations on what you're doing. It's great.
So thank you very much for listening, everyone, and we'll look forward to having you next time with us.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie.